I value people pushing as fast and as far as they are capable of going. Mm-hmm. I value seeing students rise. I value the development of expertise. I value the sort of like seriousness, the sort of rigor, the sort of structure it takes to really cultivate difficult things. It's impossible to explain to people like, yes, this person who is a pseudonym here has been working on this, all sorts of this internet nonsense with all of this under this pseudonym. And then under this pseudonym, they have done these things. And you can tell it because, you know, you start looking at
the
like
that, over here.
That scene in Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's Pepe Sylvia. It's Pepe Sylvia. As you're trying to explain, no, there is this connection here. There is this here. There is this here. At this point, the politically naive take is the cynical, democracy doesn't work, you can't actually like wrench people. No, if you can actually persuade people, if you can actually get people on your side, if you actually have a message, have specific ideas, have things that work, and show people that it can be electorally successful, then you can, in fact, change things.
So today I'm talking with Jack Despain-Zo, also known as Tracing Wood Grains online, and internet commentator, investigative journalist, former Mormon, former Air Force man, broke the story on the FAA's hiring scandal, co-founder and an executive at the Center for Educational Progress, which is a nonprofit focused on improving educational outcomes, particularly in the US. So, fair summary.
That all sounds right to me.
Okay, great. Well, like, really pleased to be talking with you today. Awful lot I'd like to cover. One of the things perhaps you're most known for is a exhaustive journalist into quite niche internet subcultures and so on. Some of these are available on your website, your blog, Tracing Wood Grains Substack. You can Google for. But just as a quick example for the audience, there's the FAA hiring scandal we talked about. You did a extensive piece into the Wikipedia admin David Gerard's work, essentially laundering his personal vendettas into the public record. Last year, I was here. We were here at Manifest. You gave a talk on the dynamics of Neopets, 20, 30 years on, 20 odd years on from when perhaps most millennials may have remembered, and the sort of social dynamics of that particular culture. Do you have like a general interest in the social dynamics of these niche cultures? Would that be fair to say, or is it more of particular interest in these individual areas?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a general interest in the dynamics of culture in general, online culture in specific, and looking in and seeing what superficially bizarre story can tell us about broader social trends and broader culture.
One of the things I think is under discussed is you have, I think, you know, the impact of the algorithm on popular culture in terms of the way that, you know, it's a sort of sort by controversial element that happens with public discourse. But perhaps one thing that is under discussed is the fact that you actually, alongside that, have these very almost dictatorial power schemes where a few individuals can end up controlling, a vast swath of, or, you know, from the population point of view, 300 million people, a tiny community, but potentially hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people engaged in some topic or sort of under the whims of a particular individual.
Yeah. So one thing I like to say when you're talking about this sort of thing is, first off, nobody does anything. That is to say, if you are doing anything at all out of the standard bounds of whatever job you're in, whatever hobby you're in, anything like that, as soon as you are commenting online even, you are already entering something of a minority. As soon as you are doing a little bit of research into a topic, you are entering a smaller minority. As soon as you like read one book about something relative to almost everyone, even though in an absolute sense you're going to be a complete amateur at that thing, you're going to be an expert in that sense. Now, how this applies to some of these subcultural dynamics, if you find in any community the two or three people who do things, then you will know the shape of that community and the impact it is likely to have on the outside world. If you look at any news item that pops up that seems like why is everyone suddenly talking about this? And I can give a good example. Last year or so, you had a big, suddenly a big news flurry around whether the UK should ban the American Bully XL dog. And the answer to why are people suddenly talking about this? In that case, a big part of the answer to that comes down to seven people who looked around, weren't professionals in it, didn't have any background experience, anything like that, but looked and were like, this doesn't make sense. This is an issue that we would like to handle. This is an issue we would like to raise the salience of. Suddenly, every time they find out about one of those dog attacks, they boost it on social media. They go to news organizations. They point out things like that. And
these Brits we're talking about?
Yes,
seven Brits? Okay.
Yes.
Because sometimes these, you know, you could have like eight Americans doing something and then an issue pops up in Australia or the UK, you know?
Right.
But in this case, it's seven British people in a dedicated campaign, essentially.
Yes.
To try and, you know, affect this particular piece of policy.
Yes. And, you know, some of them put together a group with a name, so forth. And in general, they just started writing and talking and thinking about this. All of a sudden, everyone has an opinion on American Bully XLs and whether they should be banned in Britain.
Sure.
Even people who, you know, live in America, people far from it, suddenly you have all these dynamic conversations about dog breeds and attacks and things like that, and it becomes this heated thing for people to talk and think about. It doesn't happen without a small group of people raising the salience of this. And I don't want to cite that as an example of this is a rare, isolated incidence of someone doing this. I want to cite it as an example of almost everything that ends up becoming a topic of conversation happens because a very small group of dedicated people wants it to do so. And in general, if you look at any specific, like hyper-specific academic debate or hyper-specific policy debate, you're going to find about five people in that policy debate who really matter, and then everyone else is echoing their opinions.
Sure. And I can think of other examples. Like there's the sudden prominence of anti-work, which is a sort of extremely niche subreddit, and then suddenly the moderator finds themselves on Fox News. And that's quite an interesting case, actually, because and one that's perhaps illustrative is, as I understand it, that admin was, you know, an early founder of the moderator of the subreddit, an early founder of that particular subreddit. And over time, the culture had sort of drifted away from the very like diehard, we literally mean anti-work. And yet, you know, suddenly this kind of growing community finds itself in the spotlight of national news media and these particular individuals. But what I guess I'm interested in is the, you know, maybe the 99% of cases when that doesn't happen, and that you're a niche culture that affects, you know, the lives of, you know, tens of thousands of people potentially involved in some small online community that are kind of affected nonetheless by, you know, the three people, the seven people who show up and are kind of moderating the forum and setting the standards and of discourse and so on. And this is something you've seemed to do a lot of work in. You know, I mentioned Neopets earlier. You're, as I understand, you're giving a talk about the later this weekend on you know how this is played out with the furry community. You know, and I guess I just wonder, like sociologically, is that something that's like what are we to make of this? I suppose. Like in terms of the how culture evolves and the fact that, you know, you're these positions of power that are essentially almost entirely kind of examined, that you've got almost like absolute dictatorial power within these, you know, communities to three people that happen to show up or happen to be there first. And that's only really you investigating them, or maybe, you know, a few online individuals like yourself, and then aside from those very rare minority of cases where it becomes national media.
Right. So I don't want to overstate the dictatorial power aspect in that, yes, they have control over these communities, they direct it, but usually in niche online spaces, like power belongs to those who show up.
Sure.
And so I don't want to overstate that dynamic. But yeah, to give an idea of what I'm talking about with this, the furry slayer is the story I call it.
Sure.
Because you're right, it is a relevant thing of this. This person was the founder of like Reddit's premier quote-unquote anti-furry subreddit. And then through a convoluted series of events and acting like he belonged, he became a furry power moderator over like a lot of very mainstream subreddits and a lot of very large places on it, and caused several major news stories about Discord, about Reddit, caused several pretty large, or exposed a couple of pretty large scandals with all of that, and behind the scenes with all of this became incredibly influential with that. So yeah, what do you do about these times that the only reason I know that this person exists and that this story exists is because I ran into both of his identities in a niche online forum and got to know them a little bit and slowly over time started realizing, holy cow.
This guy had been managing like 8 different accounts and, yeah. And sort of like, how does a you know, member of the new, journalist at the New York Times possibly kind of begin to understand?
Right. Like it's impossible to explain to people like, yes, this person who is a pseudonym here has been working on this, all sorts of this internet nonsense with all of this under this pseudonym, and then under this pseudonym they have done these things, and you can tell it because, you know, you start looking at
the
like
group chats that, over
that scene in Always Sunny in Philadelphia, it's Pepe Sylvia as you're trying to explain, no, there is this connection here, there is this here. Yeah, and it's almost completely illegible from the outside, but you have people who are willing to spend a great deal of time and attention and energy on all these things that sometimes it's common knowledge in a niche sphere, sometimes it's not common knowledge. In this case, this one, I was one of a very small handful of people who ended up figuring out these two people are the same person.
Right.
But yeah, and what do you do about all of that? I think the main thing is just awareness that in a lot of cases, you're going to have these communities that most people don't want to pay attention to most things most of the time. Going on to Nobody Does Anything, everybody loves when something is someone else's problem. And so if you have a community that's just rolling along and you have a couple of people handling it, a lot of the same people who handle communities online who have the peculiar psychological traits necessary to say, I want to spend a lot of my time online wrangling something, some small niche space, they're also going to be very strange people, yes, a lot of times. And you just kind of need to accept that in a lot of these online spaces, because these very strange people are sort of the load-bearing mechanisms that keeps the whole thing rolling. Mm. But whenever it gains broader cultural relevance, whenever one of these spaces that's just been chugging along under the surface, whatever, gains broader cultural relevance, there will always be skeletons to uncover. There will always be like weird things going on. There will always be like niche internecine drama that goes for years and years and sure, all
so,
that.
So yeah. Do we in effect then rely on the sort of very minor social credibility, social cred and maybe small financial incentives of Substackers like yourself to sort of do the investigatory work into those spaces? Is there probably there's a small overlap of people in the world today who have, you know, the incentives to spend an enormous amount of time, you know, doing the exhaustive research to find out on the one hand, but also the kind of like quasi specialist knowledge, you might think of it, to, right, you know, properly go through the Discord servers and understand, like, you know, that maybe they were using a VPN and this, you know, there's all kinds of things which in each one of these cases is going to be quite, its own specialized, you know, series of expertise. There's some general knowledge, of course, of, you know, internet and how it works that maybe, you know, younger generations might understand better. But you're talking about, in your case, you know, really quite fine-grained understanding, yeah, required in order to be able to even begin to put those connections together. So are we reliant on, you know, is this the future of, in a certain sense, not all journalism, but of that kind of like investigative journalism as the internet continues to kind of soak up more of society?
You know, I would say, in this specific case of the internet, we could say it's the future of it. In a general case, we can say it is the past, the present, and the future of writing, of history, of investigative journalism. Things happen because one curious, peculiar person is like, I would like to figure out this story, and they go and do it.
Right.
Stories get written about in even major institutions and even, yeah, major outlets because a few people care passionately about this weird niche thing and are willing to dive in and go through all the stories.
Herodotus.
Like, all of this stuff, yes. All of this is extremely expertise constrained. You're going to, a lot of people as beginning writers will look around and will say, oh my gosh, there is so much writing in the world. What could I possibly have to add to this mess? As soon as someone is feeling like that, they just need to get a little bit more specific. Like, what specific narrow things do they care about? What specific narrow areas matter? Because almost every specific narrow thing like that, as soon as you're like getting into a niche internet forum, as soon as you're getting into a specific sub policy topic, whatever, almost everything there is going to be expertise constrained, is going to be constrained by time and effort and someone just willing to do something like that. And yeah, it's that's just the way it is.
Right. So on that note, you know, if those spaces belong to people that show up, or more generally, you might think of like the segment of any particular generation that has a certain conscientiousness on the one hand, but also power-seeking kind of tendencies in some respects. You know, it's one of the things I've been interested in recently is this idea that, you know, let's say 200 years ago, Napoleonic Wars, you know, there's this very stable, institutionalized kind of pathway for young leaders. You know, you're maybe in the Royal Navy, you're midshipman in your early teens, you become a lieutenant, you maybe ending up captaining your own ship at 25. And then really in the prime of your life, you're leading the battle, you know, the British Navy at the Battle of Trafalgar and beating the French. If as society ages, we seem, you know, the formal positions of authority and power where people can kind of learn the ropes of and the sorts of people that are sort of seeking out that anyway, instead maybe gravitate more and more towards these kind of like niche areas where you can exercise leadership in some respects and help build something, you know, this sort of tendency, whether that's, you know, the kind of communities that we're talking about, could also be, you know, like a World of Warcraft guild leader, those sorts of things. Is that a kind of a fair statement that like the next generation of leaders are probably increasingly going to be coming from that kind of background rather than maybe a formal institutional background? I mean, do we see this in U.S. politics at the moment?
Yeah.
J.D. Vance bringing on know, the online alt-right and so on?
Absolutely. I think particularly so. Right now in the United States, at least, the left wing in the United States is going to be a lot more reliant and has been a lot more reliant on institutions, in part because it can count on institutions, in part because the great majority of people going to college, people going to professional school, people who are in these disciplines and thinking about these disciplines in the structured academic way are going to be at least somewhat sympathetic to their frame, whereas the right wing in America...
And this is just generally as like almost a consequence of just the sorting nature, like hyper-sorting nature of modernity in some respects, right?
You can point to some psychological traits, you can point to some traits inherent in the institutions themselves and some like contingent things of culture.
Just hyper-specialization as well, like more generally.
Right. You could look at like, say, the personality type drawn to high prestige, low pay positions, for example, and they tend to be more higher openness to experience, which tends to lead to a more liberal outlook, things like that. You can point to that sort of thing. And so both the right wing and then just in general, people who are dissatisfied with the state of the institutions have had to look outside those and look around these informal structures. More generally, I think you raised a really good point talking about, you know, someone who might have been in this core powerful position 100, 200 years ago might be like a guild leader in World of Warcraft now. This is, I think, in fact, a really healthy thing overall that you... are not going to have everyone as a winner in the same skill hierarchy, in the same like money, talent, whatever hierarchy. Some people will be winners, some people will be losers, as long as you have one hierarchy. I care a great deal about developing expertise, and I care a great deal about understanding how people can climb meaningful hierarchies, develop meaningful skills, and do things like that. If my message to everyone was like, and you will wind up at different parts of the same hierarchy, and you will always be less than people in this and this and this and this and this, that is an extraordinarily discouraging message.
Yeah, it's a very grim society in general.
It is. But the world isn't like that, and culture isn't like that. People are incredibly adept at creating all of these niche hierarchies, niche skills, niche focused areas where a lot of people with a little bit of drive, a little bit of passion, you know, can become the best storyteller in the village of this little hierarchy, the best person to go to for this really specific combination of topics.
So you're optimistic in a sense, thinking about like the future of you know, great companies and you know, institutions generally in terms of the like the training ground that this provides for people? Is that kind of where you were going?
So yeah, I mean, I think it's healthy to have this general spread of things. I also think there's sometimes this presumption that, oh, people should just give this up. That like, say, for example, oh, all these young people used to get so much into power and everything, and all of these boomers in politics keep holding on to these positions until they like keel over in office, and when is it going to be our turn type of thing. I think this sort of passivity and this sort of like blaming people for holding on to power is just this, just an incredibly like self-defeating attitude.
Sure.
That people don't just like give power up. People don't just give influence up. People don't just turn to someone new and say, you know, I've had a fun run. I've had a good time with this all. And you have a lot of different ideas to me. And you're much younger. And you're smarter. And you're cooler than me. And you're just generally better than me.
So why don't... Once in the history of the world.
Right. So why don't you take charge? Like, yeah, like yeah. People do need to understand. And I look at this in the education system. Look, my nonprofit wants to change a great deal in the education system. And I think that, for example, education schools are deeply flawed. They're deeply broken. It would be too easy of me, a bit too pat, to just blame the people in the education schools and say, how dare they like teach these things that they believe in and set up the structure they believe in and do the best they can. Like,
and take positive action. And
right. Like, I think that a lot of those things suck, but really I'm a lot more inclined to blame the people like me who haven't put in the time and effort and energy needed to explain it, to build the institutions that matter with it, and to actually do meaningful things with it. And I think that, that's my response to a lot of these concerns about like these traditional hierarchies in general, is that people just need to get
better. So what's your, like, your theory of change on this? Because, you know, I recall after the Trump election last year, you made a bit of a splash on the sort of centrist manifesto online, particularly Twitter. And again, people can read that on your Substack. Your work more generally with the Center for Educational Excellence, Center for Educational Progress is again, a sort of as you say, manifestation of this, or an attempt to kind of bring something together. But I guess I'm just wondering, let's just focus for a moment on the centrism side of essentially it's a project or an idea of reforming the Democratic Party.
Right.
To what extent is this what's your theory of change on this? Because like I would say the structural forces that are pushing like politics more generally tend to be, you know, more towards like satisfying the kind of more extremists within any particular group, because as we were talking about earlier, those are the people that are showing up. So how does, a centrist idea or more kind of old school principles like that are perhaps increasingly unfashionable because they don't tend to go viral. I've been thinking a lot about the rule of law recently as something that's, I almost never hear talked about it yet as one of the more fundamental kind of aspects of the prosperity that we now, stability that we now enjoy. Look, but how do you make a viral post about something that's like broadly accepted, in a kind of wishy-washy way? Nobody kind of, oh yeah, that seems fine. And then more, so as I said, there's like, it seems to me to be a structural push towards, as we said, like the more extremes of any particular party or organization and satisfying those groups. So like how do you reform the Democratic Party given those circumstances? Right.
Fantastic question. First off, I want to look at your question, how do you make a viral post about a wishy-washy thing that everyone sort of cares about, everyone sort of likes? Because I actually think there are really good answers here, which are, for example, you look for, why do you care about this? Why is this suddenly an issue for you? And usually it's because you are seeing areas where that is failing. You're seeing areas where that can't be relied on the same way. You know, if it was a fully well-functioning system, then you wouldn't care. And if you're noticing some of these flaws, then other people are going to be noticing some of these flaws as well. Then you are going to usually, if you're astute, you're going to be somewhat in tune with some sort of zeitgeist with it. Then what you want to find is, well, what is a story that really captures this? What is a story that really captures the essence of this? What is not just talking about the general principle, everyone can talk about general principles forever, but what is an actual event that gives people a crystal clear example of, this is why I care about this, and this is what happens when you stop caring about this, this is what happens when you start caring about this, so forth. And then you just drill that into a really cohesive, compelling, clear narrative, pointing out, basically telling people, this is why this all matters. And if it's something that everyone already sort of wishy-washy agrees with anyway, people love nothing more than reading things they agree with. If someone can go in and say something where someone's like, oh, I have been thinking this my whole life. Finally, someone says it. Like, those are the essays that really catch people. But you need to say it right. It's not enough to say it in the same wishy-washy way that everyone else can sort of say it. Like, you need to be
sure.
just effective with it.
Although, right? you know, I great answer. I think, though, just to challenge some pushback a little sure. bit, I suppose, you know, there are, however, like a set of principles, and I think the rule of law is one. It's maybe it's not even fair to say that they wishy-washy. They probably never thought about it at all.
Right.
Right. So there's a host of generational issues that I think are we're beginning to emerge, and we've kind of talked a little bit about one of them. We're talking around, I suppose, is so you've got a host of people, maybe highly principled, silent generation, greatest generation that are
sure. kind
of increasingly, you know, that held very strong, you know, ideas about all manner of things. And in some cases, we've moved on from them and said, you know, consciously as a society, changed our views on, you know, particular issues. And we could call that progress. There are other cases where, you know, these were just, you know, the water that people swam in,
sure.
you know, 80 years ago, and it's not the water that people swim in today, or right. it is, they swim in it, but they don't realize it. I'm mixing metaphors a little bit here, but do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah. That things that could be assumed as tacit knowledge in past generations and present there generations have sort of degraded and yeah. been set aside.
So does this affect the kind of thesis that you're talking about, where it's not necessarily the kind of thing that people agree with? If they really thought about it, perhaps they would go, yeah, that's important for a society, but maybe they've just never given any thought to it at all.
Right. So I can really speak to this one actually, because I come from a very different cultural background than almost all of my peers, because I was raised in an extremely LDS environment.
There's Mormons.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Mormons. And took it very seriously until about 21, and then stepped away from it and stepped into this world that everyone else had created in broader culture, and looked around and said, wow, this culture is insane. And look, Mormon culture was insane, whatever, in its own ways. It was my sort of insane. I understood it, and I understood a lot of the tacit stuff that you're talking about that sort of stepped away in other places. Like, I had that. What I found is, and what I find in my writing a lot of times, and this is one reason I write so passionately, is that a lot of times I'll be looking around a subculture around me, a general cultural trend, whatever, and I will think, nobody gets what I am trying to get at here. Nobody gets this value that I feel very strongly. Nobody gets one thing or another. And surely I have all sorts of opposition on this because nobody is talking about this right. Nobody is saying this in the right way. And then a lot of times what will happen is I will sit down and I will think about how best, most effectively to convey my thoughts on one of these things and use good examples and present it in a clear way and everything. And I'll go in and be sort of not looking for a fight, but anticipating pushback.
Right.
And everyone agrees with
just
me.
Just open door. Yeah. And then you shape the conversation going forward.
Exactly. And so like I go into a community, I'm like, why is nobody talking about this? I go in, I start talking about it, and suddenly people are talking about it. Like I really think a lot of this is contingent on just specific people doing specific things sure. and people effectively advocating for and talking about the things they care about.
So coming back then to this idea of the you know, centrism in the Democrat
yes.
Party, which actually let's just take a moment, like because I think there's a within Manifest, within the kind of internet subcultures that we inhabit, there's a sort of a broad understanding of what we mean by that, of the sort of like a state capacity liberalism almost. Would that be, you know,
yes.
a focus on excellence and delivery and you know, revivifying the state in order to be able to
absolutely
provide. Would that be a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that within current Democratic Party trends and language, like understanding basically the abundance agenda, how do we effectively deliver the things that we care about?
Sure. So then coming to this question of reform and you know, changing the minds of the Democratic Party, or even I suppose the Republicans, or you know,
sure.
both sides of the House, ultimately you'd ideally want to shape the views of, is your answer so far is you know, around shaping the world of ideas. Is that, do you see that as like the primary vehicle for achieving your goals in this sense?
So let me give an example that I think really cuts to the heart of the extra institutional versus within institution dynamic. That is, if institutions are failing, and I think more than the Democratic Party, more than anything like that, what we are really experiencing is an age of institutional crisis. And ages of institutional crisis are bad because if you can't trust everything from the institutions, it doesn't suddenly make the reasons the institutions existed less important. It doesn't mean that suddenly you can trust everything outside the institutions.
No.
And so it creates this sort of lower trust in everything and leads a lot of people to wander into chaotic areas. And I think we're really seeing that in a lot of domains. But one specific domain we're seeing it in is journalism.
Sure.
The premier journalistic institution, ask pretty much anyone who has thought about it more than a little bit, and they'll almost uniformly answer, you know, the New York Times mm-hmm. is the premier journalistic institution. A lot of people in my circles don't like the New York Times and don't respect it. I respect the New York Times, kind of the way I respect a tiger, you know? Like, it is strong, it is powerful, it knows exactly what it wants to do, and it is very good at doing it.
Sure.
But at the same time, over the past decade, really in general, like, the New York Times has always had its beat, has always had its bias, has always had its set of values and issues that it cares more about and that it cares less about, things that it will highlight more, things that it will highlight less. Over the past decade, at least, that really started increasing in salience, and a lot of issues that would be incredibly relevant in the New York Times. So, for example, when I covered the FAA hiring scandal, and suddenly I, as an independent...
Do you want to just give like a very brief summary of that?
Yeah.
So as you said,
yes.
Go check out Substack. It's an incredible story. You go into a really great depth.
In 2014, the FAA replaced its air traffic controller hiring test with a system that the tool they used to eliminate 90% of candidates or more was a farcical biographical questionnaire that asked questions such as, what was the lowest grade you got in high school? Correct answer, science. Or what was the lowest grade you got in college? Correct answer, history. And with this questionnaire, they eliminated more than 90% of people who were qualified, people who were ready, people who had already taken the previous tests that made them eligible to join, and just threw a massive wrench into the hiring pipeline, disrupted their relationship with the schools that they had feeders in.
So we're talking about a system that was essentially explicitly, although not publicly, but designed in order to be able to give an answer key to preferred candidates.
Yes.
In order to essentially completely hire who they wanted to hire and not hire hire nobody that they didn't want to hire.
Right. So there were overlapping scandals there where an FAA employee got a bunch of candidates on a call and like started saying, you should answer this question this way, this question this way, right. This question this way. There was that. And then there was just the general reality of what happens when all the candidates other than that get basically randomly selected or randomly not selected for all of this.
Sure.
Now, this was a major scandal. It was a huge issue. It is extensively documented and was at the time. It got almost no news coverage at the time.
When you say at the time?
Like in 2014, subsequent to it.
When
like,
it actually changed.
Exactly, when it actually happened. Because
everything was public. Essentially, but just nobody went to look? Is that?
Yeah, like there were the people who were impacted were really trying hard to get people to pay attention.
They got a bit of attention here,
a bit of attention there, like Fox Business ran an investigation. But it touched on a lot of hot button issues that a lot of outlets weren't keen to really touch. And
equity in hiring, for example.
Exactly, yep. Exactly. Like it was downstream of a diversity initiative, and that touches on a lot of sensitive things. And one way or another, a lot of outlets just didn't touch it. And so suddenly I come in last year and I start writing about this. I find out about the lawsuit that's still ongoing with it, the class action lawsuit that at the time was Brigada versus Buttigieg. I don't know what it's been updated to, but generally against the Department of Transportation. And I wrote about it. I documented it. And suddenly this story went incredibly viral. Suddenly a ton of people who hadn't heard about this started paying attention, listened, cared, so forth, and it made a huge splash. Now, I should not have gotten that scoop. The New York Times should have covered this extensively. This is something that the New York Times should have and could have documented very, very thoroughly in their, massage things to fit the frame that they want, but gently tell people this is how it all happened style.
Sure.
And they didn't. What happens in a situation like that?
Mm.
Well, institutions like the New York Times start adapting. They don't actually like when things get... when major, major things start being missed, when people start distrusting them, when people start thinking like, we can't rely on them for
even
this.
If nothing else, just want to maintain eyeballs on them rather than you.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so mine can be seen as sort of a specific instance of the general principle of the Substack ecosystem emerging. As this system of decentralized eyeballs on them rather than eyeballs on your things emerges, it has two beneficial effects. Number one, it has the beneficial effect of things are getting attention that would not get attention otherwise because you have all these passionate, decentralized people looking at these things.
Mm.
Number two, you have suddenly a very strong incentive for the institution that had whatever flaw existed such that this new ecosystem needed to come up. It
sure.
suddenly needs to respond to and react to and figure out how to counter this institution.
Sure.
And one of the ways it does that is, for example, suddenly the New York Times hires John McWhorter, who is considered like a fairly heterodox linguist, so forth. They start looking for, say, reaching out to people like me to write stories for them, and they adapt. So this is the zooming back out to the Democratic Party, things
or,
like
or institutions more generally, because just thinking about this a little further, you're essentially proposing constructing a parallel institution.
Yes.
Which I can see, like, journalism, you know, you decentralize journalism in some respects, and then that forces the establishment to sort of update its practices. How does this work more generally? You know, when you think about, like, a DMV type, you know, the Department of Motor Vehicles is sort of like a cliched, terrible institution, long queues and so on. How does it work in that kind of case?
Sure. So you won't be building a parallel DMV, but you can build a parallel set of, like, if nobody is talking about the DMV being a problem and the DMV is a problem, you can build a set of, like, small-scale institutions that point out. Because things like that are often problems because nobody's really... because they've achieved some sort of like inertia. Nobody's really thinking about how to impact
maybe
the
an acceptance almost
exactly.
amongst the, you know,
exactly.
a broader population of, oh, it's just, it's always going to be shit.
Yeah. And so you can pull a small set of passionate people together who think about these nuts and bolts issues, drill into them, come up with serious specific answers for them, and make it very, very easy. This is the key. Make it very, very easy for people to say, oh, this is our go-to for how we solve this with this thing. And maybe you won't get the first person. Maybe you won't get the first group. But then you have someone else coming in looking to make a splash, looking to impress people. They're like, I am different from this first group. What's going to set me apart? Well, these guys have really cool ideas about DMVs that
they might not even necessarily mention you and
exactly.
But it's like, we've got a plan.
Right.
And suddenly...
right.
There's some enormous political kind of mandate to fix this really nice issue in this way.
Yes. Now, zooming to the Democratic Party with this, the issue that the Democratic Party has faced is that their base and their people who are most passionate, the people who their volunteers are drawn from, the people who their staffers are drawn from, the young educated professionals who make up the actual party elements of the Democratic Party are far to the left of the median American. They are far more uniformly progressive. They have adopted a set of ideas that are unpopular among America, but extremely popular among their niche areas, and made some of these things litmus tests, so forth. So in the 2020 primary, you had an example of all of these candidates pandering to this group of people. Except for one or two of them. And suddenly, like, the old, unfashionable, moderate-seeming candidate won. But a lot of people who voted for Biden as this moderate seeming, whatever, old, unfashionable, not all of these things, wound up being somewhat disappointed by this because he ran to the center and then hired all of those staffers and hired all of those people and brought in all of that culture. And suddenly...
did he even have a choice in some respects, though,
In many respects, no.
You were talking about earlier.
Because those are the people who are available, because those are the people who are around running things, those are the people who are passionate about things, because... as the saying goes, personnel is policy. you get
people,
the policies.
People, ideas, machines, in that order.
Yeah. You get the policies downstream of the machines of people who care about them.
Yeah.
And so the issue that people like me are facing is that in a lot of ways, you can point to electoral politics. You can point to, for example, in education, electoral politics. I care a lot about advanced classes and looking for ways to raise the ceiling in education. This is extremely popular among the general public. In fact, David Shore, who does a lot of polling for the Democratic Party, his group Blue Rose Research, looked at a lot of questions of this policy initiative from Democrats, how popular is this one, how unpopular is this one? The single least popular initiative in the Democratic Party was removing advanced classes. It was less popular than defund the police.
Right.
So why do we keep having fights over remove advanced classes versus not remove advanced classes? Because there is infrastructure around removing advanced classes, because there are people who care passionately about this, who think about this, and everyone who thinks like, I actually don't want advanced classes to be removed. I actually think it's good when people learn, so forth. They're just kind of counting on somebody else to do that work for them.
Sure.
They're counting on somebody else to figure that all out. And when someone does, so for example, in San Francisco, when people realized we have stopped teaching algebra to eighth graders and we are in fact banning them from learning it, so forth, suddenly they start a ballot initiative with it. It is by far the most popular ballot initiative that the people who worked on it ever worked on, talking to one of them, and it passes 80% to 20% because everyone cares about this.
Sure.
As soon as they're made to care about it. So what do you need to do? You need to get serious about organizing for ideas that are worthwhile and effective,
yep.
Not blaming people who have already organized for other ideas, but just doing the work of meaningful things.
So I think I like really love that. And I can see how your sort of whole modus operandi over the last few years has sort of been focused in this direction. But I guess one of the sort of, you seem, that's not a model though for kind of change on the margins, that essentially, you know, we're talking about creating a campaign to fix this particular issue and this particular issue under the sort of assumption that the people running the infrastructure, shall we say, will continue. So, you know, that I haven't, will continue to be kind of this sort of hyper niche, you know, group of ideologues. How like, does that need to change?
Of course it needs to change.
So how does that change?
I mean, how it changes, like, this is where it goes back to people don't actually give power up willingly.
Right.
And if someone has power, and if you're looking around and you're saying, wow, it sure sucks that a lot of bad people have power. Yeah, they're pretty glad about it. They worked very hard to keep it that way.
Sure.
And you just need to go through the same difficult tasks of organization and structure and rallying around ideas and all of the, like, nuts and bolts of political work that of the many, you know, I love my coalition. I love the, like, niche esoteric center, whatever, all of that. One thing that I don't love about them is that they are extremely anti-tribal and extremely, in a lot of ways, politics skeptical. Like, there's a lot of people who just want to grill. There are a lot of people who want to, like, work on their niche, non-controversial problems and hope other things take care of themselves. And at some point, you do need to be willing to just dive in and organize and say, we care about a lot of these issues. We care about them together. We recognize the power dynamics in play. We recognize the groups in play and the reasons other people are having power over these things. And we are willing to do what it takes to organize over that.
It's just like a revival of democracy in a sort of Tocquevillian sense, almost, you're advocating.
Yeah, and I think that, like, people, so I used to be really cynical about the American democratic system. Like, oh, you know, we have these two parties who have a stranglehold over everything, all of that stuff. And I think that anyone who feels that way, like feels like, oh, these two parties have a stranglehold and nothing can be done after A, Donald Trump completely wrenched the Republican Party to his will, and then B, Bernie Sanders, a socialist, which is not, in fact, a popular thing in America, almost wrenched the Democratic Party to his will and then substantially shifted their platform towards his and forced them to adapt in response to him. Like, at this point, the politically naive take is the cynical, democracy doesn't work, you can't actually, like, wrench people. No, if you can actually persuade people, if you can actually get people on your side, if you actually have a message, have specific ideas, have things that work, and show people that it can be electorally successful, then you can, in fact, change things both on a small scale and then if you are, you know. So as an example of, like, hard mechanics, you get someone up on the debate stage who is, like, this centrist, wonky type of person, and suddenly their ideas are in the conversation. Probably they don't win in the Democratic Party.
This is like Pete Buttigieg, is it?
You know, I love Pete Buttigieg. He's more mainstream left than the sort of thing I'm thinking about. Like, say, you get one of the progress studies guys up there, say, who's on the debate stage talking about all this progress studies stuff. Suddenly, that's part of the conversation. And it doesn't necessarily win, but when they're looking for who's in our coalition, who are we trying to include, who are we trying to do these things, whose ideas are we trying to pull from, that comes in. And maybe 4 years later, that sort of ideas is really successful. There are a lot of people who are excited and passionate about it. Suddenly it's in a position to win. And that's the sort of thing that I think you need to do to gain power, is just take very seriously this process.
So I've been thinking a lot about the like incredible achievements of the state in the 20th century. And, you know, we can, early 20th century in particular, and we can point to, you know, classic examples of the Manhattan Project or the Apollo program. And but I also see it in like the everyday and in local kind of city councils, of like you go up into the bush behind Auckland and there's this enormous great big concrete dam built in, you know, I think it's 1911, without modern machinery, like without modern logistics, and there's this just towering kind of monument to, I guess, progress.
Yes.
And so the, you know, there's a whole host of problems that, you know, our ancestors, should we say, faced, of how do we provide clean water to people. And there was a whole kind of generations for which involvement in working with the state, either as a, you know, a contractor or directly being involved in your local kind of electoral commission, you know, subgroup, like a democratic, I don't know how it works exactly in the states, but, you know, the local kind of party branch, and so on, and with this idea of kind of a mass involvement because it was needed. And then I think, you know, dynamism, you know, in the latter half of the 20th century and in the early part of the 21st, is like moved quite dramatically towards the public, the private sector.
Yes.
As, you know, generations now have sort of taken the state for granted. And because there's enormous amount of inertia in those institutions, they're set up quite deliberately to be stable over a long period of time, which in part is inhibits their dynamism.
Right.
But, you know, on the positive side, means that they're still there and largely function and aren't kind of completely tyrannical or corrupt. But over time, and particularly over generations, as the sort of the ethos, the thinking of how change happens and why, when change is required and how you reform something, is lost. And maybe, you know, you're going to see very hopeful of a revival of that kind of mentality, that actually, you know, it's sort of every generations, or sometimes it takes multiple, you know, there's a gap of multiple, but, you know, challenge for every generation. There is a challenge for every generation. Ours is, at least in part, the revivification of our institutions.
Yes.
And we do that through showing up and making really compelling cases for, you know, niche issues, but over time that for the things that matter, and over time that grows into something that's you know, broader and you know, stronger and more long lasting. Is that?
Yeah. So one thing that I like to say is we all have always been solving the problems caused by other people's solutions. That is, a lot of times through history, you have one generation that comes up and sees, you know, this is an issue. So say in education, you had people who came up, looked around and were like, we have all these disparate people who can't really read and aren't really like in this order structured thing. We're going to implement this like mass scale public schooling that does all this stuff. And they do it in a way that has some successes, some failures, but it immediately gets entrenched as, now this is the way you do things. This is the new paradigm.
And even just from an economic sense, it completely destroys the kind of capacity of any old system to compete, because it's all subsidized by the state, right?
Right. Yeah. And so suddenly, like, whatever it, you know, it was solving real problems. And then you look and say, okay, now this solution caused this and this and this. And then a new generation comes along and they're like, you know, there are these problems that are all that. Yeah. They were the solutions to other problems. Mm-hmm. But one thing that you see in connection with this, right, is that we have been really going in circles in the same policy conversations for at least three generations now.
Sure.
You look at the policy debates that we're having in 2025, AI is new. That one, you know, that's different. But a lot of things around like race equality, around like state capacity, around like this liberty versus equality tension, so forth, some of the specific things. You know, the affirmative action debate is a good example. So many of these debates, you can go back to 1960, and they were having exactly the same conversations that we are now. And so...
And this isn't necessarily a bad thing in some respects.
It's not necessarily
it's just the kind of swings of adjusting over time. The you know, the terrain changes a little bit as, you know, people shift and economics changes and people shift to the cities and so on.
Right.
Just the natural maintenance of a state is ultimately, you know, corrections and over, you know, that's inevitable.
Yeah. And if you look at, like, I don't think there was ever a golden age. I'm not going to look around and say there was this period in the past where everything was working well and everyone was satisfied. And you won't see people in those times say there was a golden age either.
Sure.
But there are times where there is more or less progress towards the things I care about, more or less, at least heading in the right direction. I think that to get to those times, you know, I can make an argument that, like, say, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, before people became really scarred by the world wars and really just, like, seemed to shrink into themselves, there was the sense that we could do everything, that we could build, and we were conquering the natural world, and we were understanding, like, our dynamism, our technology, our world affairs, all that, can change everything, exactly. And then, like, the world wars hit, and we realized all the downsides of all this power that we had been cultivating, all this mastery of the natural world, and so forth, and we just sort of shrunk into ourselves. You know, you can you can point to those things, you can make those cases, but the lingering message for me with it all is that, like, each era wanders into its own problems, and then people each time more or less come to the same conclusion, which is, who else is going to fix this? Like, we're running into this, and a lot of it was caused by previous eras, sure, a lot of it was caused by, like, failures to maintain, a lot of it's caused by whatever causes you want to identify, like, ultimately, the solution is almost always the same, which is people responding to those problems and taking them seriously, understanding the cultural forces of their day, and working within that to do something meaningful.
So I want to turn now, you know, really dive into some of your work around the Center for Educational Progress, and I have some questions here. You've previously written a lot about this kind of idea that there, you know, there's a myth out there that top students can take care of themselves.
Yes.
They don't tend to be, like, problematic, like a obvious problem in a classroom, and yet the system's sort of failing them, and this is, like, quite clear in the academic literature that we're not providing anywhere enough opportunity for these people to extend themselves. And as a result, they're behind where they should be, and society as a whole is worse off as a result of that. But on the other hand, although the literature is clear on objective questions, as soon as you get into even the opinions of the researchers themselves, let alone society as a whole, any kind of sense of shared narrative sort of falls apart. What do we make of this? Kind of descends into partisan politics. How do we change the view on that? How do we shift the view? And would that be fair to say that's, like, a large part of what you're kind of setting out to achieve?
So that is absolutely a large part of what I'm setting out to achieve. Could I get a sense of what you mean by this narrative collapsing as soon as you, like, yeah?
Well, I'm actually referring to a post that you made online several years ago, where you'd looked at a host of academic research and so on, and then you just, like, repeatedly saw that whatever the research ended up saying, people's takes on it were wildly kind of, you know, separate.
Specific questions, people will agree, and then they will zoom out to broad narratives and they will
immediately diverge. Yes.
Absolutely. So that happens for a very understandable reason, which is that people care about different things.
Sure.
And so a lot of disagreements that appear to be very direct policy disagreements, people saying this thing works or this thing works or that thing works, are really just people saying, I have these values and you have those values. And so you wind up disguising a lot of these values debates as evidence debates, because everyone wants to be able to say the evidence is on my side.
Sure.
And no one wants to say, like, this is just where my values are. So one example of the way this plays out around specifically ability grouping and helping advanced students you can look at two meta-analyses in the 1980s, or two like sets of meta-analyses, because these researchers were very passionate and each did multiple, touching on different things about whether ability grouping works. One of them, Robert Slavin, was this extremely committed egalitarian educator who was skeptical of ability grouping from a standpoint of he felt like it was inegalitarian. What he found was that if you grouped students heterogeneously versus homogeneously by ability and did not change the curriculum, then it had basically no impact on any of the students. Whereas if you, say, did like subject-specific ability grouping and reading, you would have some impact. But basically, his broad narrative that he zoomed out to with this was ability grouping doesn't work, or it doesn't have a positive impact, and because it is inegalitarian, we should default to not doing it. It wasn't. It has a negative impact, but it was because we can't find clear benefit in this frame, and it is inegalitarian, let's knock it off. Yep. On the other hand, the Kulik's, Chen Lin and James Kulik, looked at the same body of studies and then pulled in a few studies that also actually changed curriculum. And this is what you're actually supposed to do with ability grouping is, you know, you're not just supposed to say, put the smart kids together, they'll help each other in the same curriculum. You're supposed to say, tailor the curriculum to the level of the student. Mm-hmm. So they did that. They pulled in a few gifted programs, things like that. And suddenly they found a pretty dramatic impact for top students with all of this stuff. And so their takeaway was ability grouping helps this set of students pretty dramatically and it hurts nobody. Therefore, because we value this sort of excellence in education, we should have ability grouping.
Right.
And fundamentally, at root, it was a values debate. Hmm. But everyone starts parsing it as an evidence debate. They're like, it works, it doesn't work, it works, it doesn't work, yada, yada, yada. All the Slavin shows it doesn't work. The Kulik's show it does work. Hmm. I would argue pretty strongly that the evidence is on the side of ability grouping having pretty substantial, done right, having pretty substantial positive impacts for a lot of students, particularly the gold standard of cross-grade subject-specific ability grouping. But a lot more importantly than that, I value people pushing as fast and as far as they're capable of going. Mm-hmm. I value seeing students rise. I value the development of expertise. I value the sort of like seriousness, the sort of rigor, the sort of structure it takes to really cultivate difficult things. And so ability grouping and teaching students where they are at, looking at them saying you are right here, therefore we are teaching you at that level, that aligns very cleanly with those values of mine. Mm. Someone who's a lot more interested in, say, bringing all students up to the same level, or a lot more invested in, and look, I care about the performance of students at every level, but someone who sees gaps between students and says we need to devote all our time and energy on the bottom ones, like they're going to come to different conclusions just because their values diverge from mine.
Sure, and I think it's even leaving aside the question of values for a moment, you could see that in general that a curriculum or a monolithic curriculum is going to be targeted either at the bottom for values reasons or at the median, just right, because that's where most of the students are, right?
Right.
So there would be, for one reason or another, there's going to be a tendency to kind of ignore that particular segment.
Yeah, if you have a monolithic curriculum, teachers will naturally help the slower students in their classrooms, and that's probably even appropriate. You want to help people who are struggling with your curriculum.
Sure. So one of the questions that I have, I don't know how familiar you are with Soviet education, loosely. Okay, so you know, as I understand it, the particularly the math and STEM kind of curriculum in general is highly regarded. Is that sort of ultimately reliant on the fact that there isn't necessarily a lot of economic opportunity for really talented people in the private sector, or maybe at all, as a society, being able to allocate the world's best maths people to colleges, and then the next best maths people to teaching, is that replicable?
Sure.
Given like Baumol's cost disease is sort of ultimately, I think, potentially a major problem for education, where it was just
right,
the economic opportunities at the top end for really talented people and really great teachers are probably more in the kind of realm of consulting, management consulting, or working in Silicon Valley or something, rather than teaching the next generation.
Right.
So, like, how do we deal with that? Is it is it something that can be resolved?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And you're right that in the United States, teaching is a relatively low pay, low prestige profession compared to some of these other things. I mean, moderate prestige, like people like teachers, people respect sure. teachers, but yes. What I'll say with that, a couple
and just to, sorry, just to, but more than that, it almost seems like economically almost impossible. You could raise the social prestige of education. Sure. I think we should definitely do that. But raising wages, maybe you could make the argument, okay, we can do it by 20%, 30%. But on the whole, there's just no possible set of, I would imagine, like economic incentives that could recreate like a Soviet Union style quality of teaching.
Right.
Or teachers, sorry.
So let me tell you about a specific curriculum in elementary school, one that everyone has known has worked for several generations and nobody has particularly liked for several generations. And this is direct instruction. Capital D, capital I, lowercase direct instruction just refers to teaching people directly. Capital D, I, direct instruction refers to this pretty fascinating curriculum that involves ability grouping of students by subject and involves fully scripted lessons that have features like the teacher having fairly regular, like whole class call and answer, like the teacher says this, the students respond with that sort of thing. Yeah. It's this extremely, extremely structured curriculum compared right. to the standard elementary curriculum.
Okay.
And it works radically better than the standard elementary curriculum along basically every metric you care to look at.
Right.
But it clashes so much with people's instincts and it clashes so much with people's tastes that despite people having known this yeah. for generations, ever since the initial study of it compared to other curricula where it blew all of them out of the water, you know, that study suddenly, like, they backed away from the study and people like wanted to keep funding the other curricula anyway. They didn't sure. really care anyway.
It'd be quite like stultifying, I imagine, as a teacher.
Well, you'd think so. And the instinct for some people is that talking to people, you know, actors, for example, repeat lines, and that's one thing they do.
Sure.
And actors don't feel stultified in repeating lines, like that's part right. of it. Teachers who are doing this as part of their job still have the opportunity to answer specific questions, still help students
right,
in specific
okay.
ways. So basically,
but like, the nature of the creativity changes a little bit.
Yeah, the nature changes, and in general, it's like it's not in people's minds of the sort of thing they sign up for.
Mm.
That said, the reason I'm harping on this in response to this thing in specific is that is an example of a curriculum that is extremely scalable
sure.
with people who don't need to be like these individual wizards coming up with beautiful curricula and coming up with everything else. It makes it very, very easy for individual teachers to succeed in that.
Yeah.
So that's one example. Another thing that I want to touch on with this, and you're right that like economy is part of it and it will never change everything. You have a lot of people in culture who are motivated by things other than economic concerns.
Mm.
And you have in a space like this, and as you mentioned, we are at the Prediction Market Conference Manifest, which is full of people who are who would identify often as effective altruists or rationalists or so forth.
Mm.
And these effective altruists in particular, they devote themselves not to like the thing that gets the highest social prestige or the highest financial reward. A lot of times they will look and say, here is something that solves an important problem and I'm going to solve it. I'm going to work on that. I'm going to devote my time and energy and attention to this. Not necessarily glamorous, but effective thing that solves an important problem. The thing is, those groups don't really trust education has these things that can be that can solve the problems. And so they sort of siphon people who are passionate about and interested in helping people, are interested in this sort of ideas, as saying basically like education's a field where there's not really much to do, so don't worry about it, don't think about it, it's not particularly high impact. And that means that other people will enter the education system and they will be the ones who determine how it goes.
Sure. So I can definitely see that, like, on like your direct kind of goals in the more immediate sense of kind of changing views on that within, let's say, this crowd, but more generally those adjacent to it and sort of, you know, thought leaders and so on. Just coming back to this, that idea, though, of the teachers, like,
right.
How I can see that a lot of people, you know, maybe it's underrated, this idea of like for society in general of like people want to be making a positive contribution. Is that kind of what you see as like leveraging more of that is going to be useful for education at scale? Or
so I would say, like, you can leverage some of that. So for example, there is a charter school in North Carolina called the Teller Institute that I'm a big fan of, where this physicist came in and did the physicist thing of reimagining things from first principles and working from the basics with it. And he was like, of course, ability grouping for reading and math makes sense. Of course, you bring students in, test them, and then place them in a class that aligns with their test score for the subject. Like, how else would you do it? Or of course you use these curricula that are effective, this like phonics for reading, so forth. And he came in and he did all of that, and it's working well.
This is Edward Teller? Like, so it's been around for a while? Or
no, so the Teller Institute
Teller. Okay.
Yeah, by Ronak Bhatt. It's been around about 4 years now.
Oh,
so
I see.
It's pretty new. It's pretty young. But it's going very well so far. Mm-hmm. And there weren't really any major barriers to that other than someone needed to have the idea and go in and execute the idea. He is mentioning that, like, he struggles to find some teachers who are on board, in tune, and ready to teach according to their program. I don't think that's a situation caused by the U.S. not having the Soviet system and not having like these resources and everything. I think it's caused by education schools just not caring about that stuff.
Right.
I think it's caused by like the institutions training people in this stuff not really thinking about or caring about or directing people towards the things that are effective and work.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing.
So you can get into teachers training colleges, for example, or as it scales, if that happens naturally, then a lot of those barriers are going
to
go away.
Or simply like compete with them and say it's not actually helpful for teachers to get credentials from schools that don't teach them. So you want to change the credentialing rules for teachers and look for different degrees, things like that. So you can do that sort of thing. But yeah, there's no rule of the universe that says education as an academic field needs to be just like worse than economics as an academic field or mathematics as an academic field. That is not an iron law of nature. That is a contingent reality based on the way things have evolved. It's not like there is enough funding in the education world. There is enough money and seriousness and so forth that if people wanted to do useful, meaningful things in it, if people had those in mind and built a culture around it and were serious about it, we are not talent constrained in the sense of it would be impossible to find teachers and to train teachers to do this sort of thing at the economics that we have.
So I mean, the obvious kind of step forward there is like, does AI help this process, or is it more of a separate thing you're envisaging? Is it so DI as a model, how does that integrate with AI?
So that's a really good question, and I would say that I take a very Deng Xiaoping approach to a lot of things in education. That is to say, it doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. I will say this about charter schools versus public schools. I say this about AI versus direct instruction versus other models. Like, demonstrate that something catches mice and I will be on board. Now, there are a couple of schools, so Alpha School and GT, its sister school, GT School in Texas, that are doing really exciting things with AI in education, where they are pulling their students 2 hours a day into this like personalized AI program and saying, you're going to learn your core academic curriculum here. And then for 4 hours a day, they're in more advanced academic workshops, they're diverging in what are they going to do, or like school clubs or sports or other activities, just interesting, worthwhile things that you can do with a school building, right? And suddenly with these 2 hours a day of academics, 4 hours are freed up for a lot of interesting things. And that seems to be, by all accounts, working well for them. And that's one model that I'm interested in paying attention to. Let's see how well it develops, see how well it scales, see if it can be backed up.
I've seen a lot of evidence around, like, particularly for teenagers, that they're just starting far too early. They're in kind of, you know, lecture halls or classrooms for far too long. They're not learning. But I guess that, how does that integrate with, you know, like societies, the needs of parents more generally?
Right.
Like, that's why kids start where they do, because parents need to go to work. Right. But I suppose maybe the kind of new economic era that we're entering into of, you know, more working from home and so on might enable more of that, do you think?
Yeah, I think some of those things are possible. Start times, things like that, you know, those can be adjusted. Those can be experimented with. I don't find start times to be a particularly like urgent problem.
No, really, okay. But instead of altering start times, we just change the structure of the day and the hours that you have.
Right.
Available.
So more than like oh, we need more hours on this or yada, yada, yada. It's just like, how effectively are you using the hours that you have? Whatever hours you are asking people to be in a school, are you respecting their time during that time?
Sure.
Are you like seriously treating them as individual agents whose time matters, whose time should be respected, or are you dragging them through a bunch of mundane, dull stuff
because glorified babysitting?
Exactly,
almost.
Exactly. Yeah. And so if you see an institution that respects students' time and that like uses it well to make sure that they are actually effectively learning things during the hours they're supposed to be learning them, or they are doing creative, interesting, fun, innovative things during the hours that they find for that, fantastic. Yeah, so that's all.
Yeah, nice one. Anything else you wanted to kind of mention on education? I know it's like a field that you're obviously deeply involved in.
I think just the general principle of, I think a lot of people who are cynical about education are cynical for understandable reasons, because there are a lot of problems in the education system. But the closer you look at the field, the more you see really innovative and exciting things around the edges, people who are starting to coalesce into this awareness of, we want this sort of excellence in schools, we want some of these specific things, and none of this stuff happens automatically. And I really think that there has never been a better time than right now to start really caring and working seriously towards these things. If you care about education, there are people around, there are ideas that matter, that work, people who have been doing effective things in it. And it isn't just a hopeless lost cause. There is a lot that can be done in it.
Excellent sentiment. So just to, I suppose, close this out, you and I, when we were originally talking about doing this, we have a mutual friend who unfortunately wasn't able to be here, but we've been involved in various anonymous internet forum over the years, maybe this is coming full circle on our talk a little, what are some of the kind of dynamics there that more people should know about?
Yeah, so I got my start writing on obscure online forums where I would like dig up some story and bring it to a handful of people and say, hey, look at this stuff. And one of the dynamics that I think people should be aware of with that is that things that work at small scale work at large scale as well. The people who made interesting and engaging posts to audiences of like a dozen people, many of them, a few years down the line, I see them and they're making interesting and engaging posts to audiences of tens or hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Or in some cases, people that we've kind of interacted with now are like in the White House on one hand or on the Democratic Party on another.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I remember someone I was talking with on Twitter, and this was a little before my time, but it illustrates things, is like she was talking about how someone in an obscure menswear forum that she had argued with way a ton back in the day was now Michael Anton, who is significantly involved in the Trump administration and has all these things up there. And like, yeah, this is just the reality in a lot of these spaces, is that people are drawn to like-minded people, and the people who talk about things in one space are ultimately going to be the people who do that sort of thing in another. People who start in weird, obscure online forums talking about niche topics because they are passionate about them, they love thinking about them, they love arguing about them, so forth, are the same people who will broadly expand onto broader stages and do things in the public world.
Sure. So I mean, there's something of a recommendation there, I suppose, in some respects, for people to just get out and, even on that smaller scale, and tying back to what we said earlier. I am curious, though, when has that been destructive for you? Just thinking personally, like, sure, there'll be times where you think, oh, that was really great and that's helped me grow. Are there other times where superficially the same kinds of things have actually sort of had the opposite impact?
It's by and large been healthy for me, I think. Like, I could point to some specific fights or some specific drama that maybe I shouldn't have gotten caught up in, or
right,
something I maybe said wrong, whatever. I could point to some of that, but by and large, like, when I am meaningfully producing and writing things online, and I think a lot of these things like have that sort of generative spirit to them where they make it easy to do those things, I am happy.
Right.
And in general, like, they have been a positive force in my life that have led to a lot of friendships, a lot of close connections, a lot of opportunities, a lot of things that matter very much to me. And it would be misleading of me, I think, sort of trying to play a little bit too much into the very easy, like, internet is bad for your frame that I could play into with other things, like with my, you know, playing altogether too much chess, for example, online. Like that's destructive. I think playing too much chess is destructive, but I think participating in these niche discussion spaces and thinking seriously about topics, even at a small scale, and trying to write about them has been an unalloyed good in my life.
Right. So last question then, what's the experience been like to go from, you know, essentially completely anonymous, you've kind of very suddenly had a kind of, I mean, obviously,
yeah,
not yet a household name, but you've gone from a sort of being a complete anon to somebody of some renown, and we've had economics professors, you know, who know you and want to talk to you. What's that experience been like? Because it's happened over the course of really a few months.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah, it happened. The majority of it happened like from December 2023 to like January, February 2024 was like this burst, big explosion into the public consciousness, which it's, I mean, I feel extraordinarily lucky. It's fun. It's satisfying. I never had a period where I thought nobody is reading my writing, mm-hmm. you know, and that's because I was always writing within communities. I was always like looking, here is something that this community will appreciate, and writing to them, and turns out they did appreciate it. Like, and that was always fun. That was always gratifying. I never felt this urge to like really work hard to burst out onto the public stage and everything. It just sort of happened as a natural outgrowth of really loving these topics and loving writing and thinking about them and doing it in public. But in terms of what it's been like, I mean, it's fun. I like it. It's fun to have people come up to me and be like, I know who you are, whatever. It's fun to talk to one of my law school professors and mention my pseudonym and have him say, wait, I've read some of your writing. Like, it's just fun. It's gratifying. Yeah.
But you're not yet like recognized on the street on the way to the supermarket. Right. Like,
although apparently, so one of my
running from the paparazzi.
One of my friends was telling me, apparently, like on a dating app, she connected with this guy who found out she was a Temple Law student, and the guy was like, "Oh, do you know Tracy Woodgrains?" You know, she was like, "Oh yeah, he's a good friend of mine." So that's weird. That's surreal. I don't know that people are really built to handle that sort of thing. But you know, by and large, a lot of people. I don't know. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, there are these downsides, whatever. I get that. I have occasionally experienced some downsides with it. Sure. By and large, like, I love writing. I wanted to write visibly. As I have become more visible, I've been like, this is a lifelong dream for me.
Nice. So. Yeah. So I guess like a model for more people to follow, just carry on, do what you love, put yourself out there, and, you know, change will come as a result.
Something like that. And yeah, I would say specifically, like, look for ways you can be useful to the communities you are in. Every community, every single community has areas where it is expertise constrained and effort constrained, and someone who is willing to put in a little more work than everyone else to help the community out in some useful way, even as a writer, just looking at and saying, here is a story that is worth telling in this area that I know that nobody else knows better than me. Tell that story to your community, and it's worthwhile.
Wonderful. Okay, well, Tracy Woodgrains, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. Cheers.